Tamaso, that sounds better. Good. For some of you who are not familiar with the Tibetan tradition, this is one of the little rituals I do. It's part of the Tibetan tradition. I don't do much ritual, but this one I like. You sit here. This is called the Dharma throne, in case you didn't know. It's not just a, what do you call it, jack something? Back jack. This is not a back jack. This is a Dharma throne. And when you sit on the Dharma throne, then teachers in our tradition click our fingers. It's a reminder of impermanence. The way I like to phrase it is dead man talking. In other words, I'm encouraging you not to take me very seriously, because I'm not either. I'm not taking this guy seriously. He's going to be dead soon, so what's the big deal? So that's good. Ola so. Yes, I love to translate Ola so, because it doesn't mean anything at all. But it's a nice way to start. It just rolls off the tongue like spaghetti. Ola so. It's like, well then. And it's a good way to begin, good way to end, and it doesn't mean anything at all, but it just rolls off the tongue. Okie-do. So, I was asked by someone here, requested that during our three-hour session this afternoon, that I also include at least a brief introduction to the second of the major shamatha methods that we'll explore this weekend. I'm happy to do so. So, the format for this afternoon, which I'm a bit more, how do you say, acquainted with or more accustomed to, the three-hour session. 2.5 hours, I don't quite know what to do with it. It's a little bit too long for some people with bladders, you know, that fill up. But 3 hours, clearly that calls for a break. So for this three-hour session from 2 to 5, we will take a 15-minute break, more or less halfway through. And so we'll break this up. And how I'd like to, in this format I'm very familiar with, three-hour sessions, what I'd like to do is begin with 2 back-to-back sessions, 24 minutes. I think we still have a fair amount of floor space, so anybody who brought yoga cushions or have 2 zabutans that you'd like to put to go into the supine position, you're very welcome to do so. But in any case, we'll have a very brief break, maybe 1, 2, 3 minutes in between the 2 24-minute sessions. So right in place, you can stretch a little bit. For shamatha practice, distinct from Zen practice, vipassana practice, according to different traditions and so on, for shamatha practice, physical discomfort is just a flat-out nuisance. It's not helpful. It's not something to break through or anything like that. It's just a nuisance. It's distracting. And so as much as possible, for shamatha practice, if the body can be comfortable, as the old saying goes, no pain, no pain. I like that. Maybe it's just that I'm getting wimpier in my old age, which is certainly true, too. But, I figure enough pain comes my way, you know, all for free without my having to go out and cultivate it. And so the movement back and forth between the supine position, the sitting position, having relatively short sessions, stretching in between, so we can just do what's really important, and that is cultivate our hearts, our minds, with as little wear and tear as possible, and without the distraction of just nagging kneecaps and things like that. So we'll have 2 sessions. We'll have two sessions, then I'll talk about some aspects of the practice, really try to bring greater clarity to the faculties that are being refined in such practice, namely mindfulness and introspection. Talk about some of the salient features of this particular method, mindfulness of breathing. We'll take a break, and then after the break we'll have 1 session, and that'll be unsettling the mind, have some discussion about that, and that'll be an afternoon. Okay? So there's our format for the afternoon. Okay? Good. So please find a comfortable posture, whether sitting on a chair, cross-legged, or supine. All of those are good. Let the entrance to each session be inviting. As this experience of letting your awareness descend into the body, right down to the ground, a It wouldn't really be a problem at all if this elicits the type of Pavlovian response. As soon as you do so, immediately feeling your shoulders start to melt and relax. As soon as the awareness comes into the body, the facial muscles softening, the eyes softening, the forehead becoming more spacious and open. Just bringing your awareness into the field of the body and setting it at ease in a posture of relaxation and comfort. And insofar as the body is indeed comfortable, there should be little incentive or urge to move. So the stillness is not forced. It's not trapped. It's a relaxed stillness. Even in the supine position, where you're not doing anything physically to assume a posture of vigilance, which we do in the sitting position with the straight spine, the raised chest, and so forth, even in the Shavasana, or the supine position, mentally adopt a posture of vigilance. That this posture is for cultivating your attention, refining your mind. This is a practice session, not just to rest or relax. So in this way, settle your body in its natural state, relaxed, still, and vigilant. With each out-breath, release the energy behind this inner voice box that obsessively provides a commentary, even when unnecessary. Release the inner voice into effortless silence. Release your breath into its natural rhythm. Offer the out-breath with utter release, no strings attached, no constraint. And keep on releasing it until it's all released. And then simply accept the flow of the breath that flows in effortlessly. And allow the body to establish its own rhythm, whether the breath is shallow or deep, fast or slow. There may be on occasion pauses after the out-breath or even after the in-breath. Utterly disengage the impetus to control. Let the body breathe, establish its own rhythm, restore its own balance by way of the respiration. In terms of settling the mind, we begin with a sole emphasis on relaxation, cultivating a sense of ease in the mind as well as the body. To do this, allow your awareness to become diffuse, not spaced out and not nebulous, but not tightly focused either. Diffuse, like again, a fragrance filling a room, let your awareness fill the space of the body. Present, clear, calm, but not tightly focused. and for a little while, just be present. With the sensations correlated with the in and out breath, wherever they most distinctly manifest, throughout the body. Again, every out-breath is an opportunity, a delicious opportunity, to continue unraveling the pent-up tension within the body, the excess stress and constriction, to release the breath itself, to happily and gently release any thoughts, whatever their content may be. We don't have to think all the time. There can be time for quiet. Each out-breath be like a gentle gust of breeze blowing away autumn leaves. Every out-breath, gently releasing every thought, image, memory, fantasy that arises, and allowing your awareness to return to the simplicity and the quiet of the present moment. This practice, when conducted in the supine position, we will call for short the infirmary, a time for deeply resting and allowing the body to heal, the nervous system to balance itself out. But this is only the first of three qualities cultivated in the practice of shamatha. So now let's introduce the second. What you will recall is stability. Calming the mind, gently releasing the energy behind the obsessiveness of these involuntary thoughts and the compulsive grasping onto them. In order to cultivate stability, let's now more narrowly focus the attention. And insofar as we feel that we are somehow located up in the head, we direct the attention downwards. The rise. rise and fall, the expansion and contraction of the abdomen with each in and out breath. Posture is important here. In the supine position, it's all taken care of. In the sitting position, see that that abdomen can expand freely, that the abdominal muscles are loose and relaxed. And focus your bare attention, a quiet watchfulness, to just the naked tactile sensations themselves, there at the level of the abdomen, as the breath flows in and flows out. With each out-breath, relax as you did before. But now with each in-breath, gently arouse your attention. Focus clearly, focus sharply. Arouse the vividness of your attention with each in-breath. And then relax deeply with every out-breath. Treat this as a full-time job. That is, to the best of your ability, maintain an ongoing flow of engagement of your mindfulness, your awareness, with the flow of sensations of the in and out breath at the level of the abdomen. Arousing and releasing. Now, in multiple contemplative traditions of Buddhism, the Theravada, the Zen, the Tibetan, contemplatives throughout over centuries have found that it can be quite helpful in order to gently subdue this flow of obsessive thinking to count the breaths. There are different methods. No one method is better than all the others for everyone. Here's one method you might experiment with. end of inhalation, just before the exhalation begins, at the turning point. Mentally and very succinctly, count one. And then as you've done before, as you breathe out, utterly relax. Release any thoughts that come up. But gently sustain the flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath at the abdomen. The breath flows in quietly. Closely attend to these sensations through the whole course of inhalation until you come to its end and count two. Substitute many wandering thoughts with just a few. One count, one thought at the end of each inhalation. You may count just one through ten, one through ten, or you may continue counting as you wish. An important note. See that your attention, your mindfulness, is focused on the sensations of the breath. In this practice, at the level of the abdomen, do not let the practice degenerate into a mere mindfulness of counting. The counting are just milestones on the path of mindfulness of breathing, a brief punctuation with each cycle of respiration. best of your ability, maintain an ongoing flow of mindfulness, of the ongoing flow of sensations of the in and out breath. Intermittently, apply your faculty of introspection to monitor the body, to see that the posture is maintained, the breath flows unimpededly. And with your faculty of introspection, monitor the flow of attention, recognizing as swiftly as possible whether excitation has set in, your mind has been carried away by thoughts or some other distraction. If so, relax, loosen up, and let your awareness descend back to the object of mindfulness. But also use your introspective faculty to discern the occurrence of laxity, of dullness, losing the edge, starting to drift into a state of being spaced out. As soon as you note this arising, take a fresh interest in the practice, and especially during the inhalation, arouse and focus. Restore the clarity of your own attention. And let's continue practicing in silence. Take just 2 or 3 minutes to stretch in place. And if you wish to switch postures, now's the time to do it. Settle your body in its natural state. At ease, still, and vigilant. Intermittently throughout the course of the session, bring your awareness to the face, especially to the eyes and the muscles around the eyes, the forehead. Make a habit of keeping these muscles soft and loose, the face open. Then note the subtlety of the challenge of attending closely to the breath, which we can so easily, even involuntarily, regulate, modify, change with our mere preferences, and not do so. To observe very closely and continuously, while we're relinquishing all control. There's the challenge, to breathe mindfully and effortlessly. For a while, let your awareness be diffuse, that is filling the space of the body, contained, but not tight. And simply be aware of the sensations correlated with the breath, wherever they most distinctly manifest. It could be in the shoulders, the abdomen, at the nostrils, could even be in the legs. Just the sensations related to the breath, flowing in and out. Arouse and focus with each inhalation. And with each exhalation, relax completely, all the way through the end of the out-breath. Now for just a short time, narrow the focus. Focus downwards to enhance the stability of attention, a common ploy. Focus for just a little while, as we did in the last session, on the sensations of the rise and fall of the abdomen. observe the whole body of the breath, the whole course of inhalation, whole course of exhalation. Gently, continual engagement with the sensations of the breath. As you relax with each in-breath, with each out-breath, and then arouse with each in-breath, you already begin the synergistic cultivation of relaxation and stability. The mind is relaxed and it becomes calm and quiet. Now let's introduce the element of vividness by attending to coarse sensations, such as those of the rise and fall of the abdomen. Not a great deal of vividness is aroused, is not needed. So let's give ourselves a smaller target, a more subtle target. And that is the sensations of the in and out flow of the breath at the apertures of the nostrils or just above the upper lip, wherever the sensations of the breath are more distinct. Now, very importantly, as you elevate the focus of your attention, it's imperative that you keep the eyes soft and unfocused. This is absolutely not a practice in which you're directing your visual gaze to the tip of your nose. That will lead to headaches, which can become chronic. No need for that. Keep your eyes soft, your forehead spacious, your eyes, your visual awareness utterly disengaged from the meditative practice. And focus just your mental awareness on the sensations of the breath at the apertures of the nostrils or above the upper lip. Once again, attend to the whole body of the breath, the whole course of inhalation, of exhalation, and insofar as you find it helpful, you may introduce the technique of counting one brief staccato count at the end of each inhalation. And besides that one count, let your awareness be as quiet, as non-conceptual as possible, relaxing through the out-breath, arousing through the in-breath. Experiment with counting to see how useful it may be. This practice helps us to arouse, to cultivate the vividness of attention, because as we settle more and more deeply in the practice, and gradually of its own accord, the respiration calms, the sensations of the breath become subtler and subtler, and as they do so, we're presented with the challenge of arousing greater and greater vividness of attention, so that the continual engagement with the sensations of the breath can continue. So in this way, let's synergistically cultivate the relaxation, the stability, and the vividness of attention, and continue practicing in silence. Hola, so. In the pursuit of hedonic pleasure, which I think I enjoy pretty much as anyone else, it all basically hinges on arousal. We're coming in flatlined, and then we think a happy thought, recall some very pleasant memory, something sensory, something intellectual, something aesthetic, something personal. We meet a person we love to engage with. There's an arousal. We're stimulated. Pleasure arises. In this practice, we're attending to something that just by nature isn't pleasant or unpleasant. It's just sensations of the breath. And so we're focusing on something that doesn't really arouse much of anything at all. Not clinging or aversion, not hope or fear, not desire, and just there it is, sensations of the breath. And by sustaining that focus, sustaining that flow of mindfulness, we are quite literally, we're going cold turkey in a manner of speaking. Because frankly, the pursuit of hedonic pleasure can be utterly addictive in the full sense of the term. The grasping onto obsessive thinking and all the compulsive jerking around with that can really be an addiction. And as we all know, any kind of addiction, whether it's heroin or opium or whatever it may be, withdrawal symptoms can be somewhat severe, not pleasant anyway. In this mindfulness of breathing practice, we are disengaging from all the pleasant stimuli, even mental ones, and attending to something that's real, namely the sensations of the breath taking place right in the present moment. So by turning the attention away from the pursuit of pleasant stimuli to something that's quite neutral, it's a little bit like running a factory that's been running for the whole course of its history on fossil fuels and then deciding to shift over to solar. You may have a little bit of a dry spell there, you know, if you don't have enough money to put up all the solar panels at the beginning, but you're shutting down the big burners. For a little while, there may be a real dip in the energy. And then slowly you come out of that, and then you've got clean fuel. So there we are. I was at a minor life conference in the year 2000 when I first really engaged with Paul Ekman. He was at that meeting. A number of other really exceptional speakers were there, including a woman who's Taiwanese, named Jeannie Tsai. She's a professor at Stanford. And we invited her there to speak at this conference about her own research on the Taiwanese people. And one of the very interesting things that came up was the contrast between this traditional culture, the likes of which we really have in some respects globally, and the whole mood, the orientation, the pace of modernity. And as we all know, being immersed in modernity, when people are enjoying themselves, I notice, especially young people, very often instead of saying, I enjoy this or that, they'll say, I'm so excited about this new soap that I got. Or anything. But it suggests the arousal, the excitement, that we're getting a buzz off the excitation. This practice is just not exciting. Remember Ronald Reagan, you've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. Remember that? You've seen one breath, you've seen them all. You know, I mean, really, the next one's going to be probably pretty similar to the last one. And so if you're looking for excitement, you came to the wrong place. You know, but shifting away from the fossil fuels of excitement, of arousal, of the pursuit, the hunter-gatherer approach, and moving more into the cultivation, it's a shift from excitement to soothing. And that's not half bad, to actually be content for the time being with soothing. And what Jeannie Tsai said, commented in this meeting, is that contrary to this whole thing of arousal and excitation and movement and agitation and let's go have some fun, you know, she said in her traditional Taiwanese culture, that whole notion of excitement was considered to be more of like, oh, you're excited? Oh, well, would you like a massage? Can I help you get over that? You know, like, oh. That soothing was the baseline, and then moving from there. So if we consider poles, I love to find the middle way by bouncing off of extremes, which is how I've always done it. We have attachment for the good stuff over here, and then we have blockages or things that we don't like, those unpleasant stimuli. So desire, aversion, boing off the extremes. And then in mindfulness of breathing, we come right down the center, down the middle lane. Not arousing excitation, doesn't arouse aversion, right down the center. And out of that center, there first arises a sense of calm, like, it's kind of quiet in here. This ain't half bad. And then the calm goes deeper, a sense of serenity, a sense of peace, soothing, almost like you're getting an internal massage. Somebody's massaging you from the inside out. And out of that slowly, and this does differ from one person to another, one constitution to another, out of that mid-place, out of the middle lane, out of this middle way, where there first arises the calm, the serenity, the peacefulness, the quiet, there may then gradually, like water just gently emerging from an artesian well through the sand, you may experience a sense of well-being, something with a positive valence arising. Like, this is really okay. And the chime goes off and said, I don't have anything else to do? Cool. It starts to be pleasant. And as the waters of the mind settle and layers of sedimentation, the turbulence, the murk, the excitation, and the laxity of the mind gradually calms, then the luminosity, the limpidity, the transparency of your own awareness may more and more manifest, and out of that same taste, a sense of well-being, and it may even turn into bliss. Sooner or later, it will. Some people sooner, some people later. But bliss will arise out of the midpoint. Not out of some pleasant stimulus, right? Because we're looking at something that makes us happy. But the sense of well-being is arising right out of the midpoint, right out of the middle, arising as a symptom of the mind becoming balanced and healthy. So among all of the many teachings the Buddha gave over 45 years, so happily he was not martyred, so glad. During these many years that he taught, there was no practice that he taught more frequently or with greater emphasis than mindfulness of breathing. As I mentioned earlier, it was especially taught as a shamatha method, especially taught for people with conceptually turbulent minds. It can also segue right into full-fledged vipassana practice. So anybody who studied the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddhist discourse on mindfulness of in and out breathing, you know it comes in 16 phases. The first four are all about shamatha. The next 12, it's all vipassana, and it culminates in becoming an arhat, you know, achieving liberation. So this mindfulness of breathing is not trivial. It's not just some beginner thing that we have to get through until we get on to the good stuff. And the Buddha used a metaphor here, which I really love, and I've lived in India for about 6 years, and so as soon as he speaks about the seasons there, and the last month of the hot season, boy, do I know what he's talking about. So here's the metaphor. Oh, by the way, I noticed that you don't have what I have, and that's notes. And I always give out my notes, but I just forgot this time. So I've notified a couple of the staff members here, and either at the end of the session they'll be available, or if somehow you don't get them, then digitally. But they're there, they're free, and you can use them any way you like. Just don't, you know, just use them. Use them. It's not, how do you say, if the table leg in your kitchen needs a bit of propping up, don't use them for that. Okay. You get them. Okay. All right, it's 4 pages of notes, but then there they are, and they're accurate, so you don't need to scribble everything I'm saying. But here's the metaphor he gave. This is from the Pali Canon. Just as in the last month of the hot season, so anybody who knows India, hot season, last month, well, the monsoon starts kicking in about mid-June, quite clockwork-like. You get to late May, early June in the Punjab, in Bihar. Oh, ho, 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 you don't want to be there. If you can be anywhere else, you'd really like to go there. Because it's hot, it's sweltering, and the air quality is awful. And that was true even before there were 900 million Indians. Probably had, oh, who knows, 10% of them at that time. So last month of the hot season, really, really nasty weather. sweltering, it'd be 120 degrees. And the air quality, all the dust coming up in the air, it's really muggy, it's awful. Just in the last month of the hot season, before the monsoon breaks, and you get this relief from the water coming down, cleansing the air and so forth. So imagine the first week of June, last week of May. In the last month of the hot season, when a mass of dust and dirt has swirled up, a great rain cloud out of season. That is, the monsoon hasn't come yet, but nevertheless, lo and behold, there's a great rain cloud out of season, disperses it and quells it on the spot. Oh, you just want to go out and dance in the rain when that happens. Because in an instant, that terrible air quality is just now clarified and it's refreshing. Even though it's hot, you have some moisture there. It gets kind of bearable. But in an instant, it quells and it disperses and quells on the spot all the dust and dirt that swirled up in the air. There's the metaphor. He says, so too, concentration by mindfulness of breathing. Anapanasati samadhi. So concentration, it has kind of a gnarly connotation in Tibetan. It sounds like orange juice with all the fluid taken out of it. But the term samadhi doesn't have a notion of tightness, of tunnel vision, not necessarily. What it does have, as I've mentioned before, samadhi. Sam means totally. A means really. And D comes from the Sanskrit verbal root dha, which means to place. So you're really totally placing your mind together. It's composure. It's unification. It's wholeness. So it's samadhi by way of mindfulness of breathing. So samadhi by way of mindfulness of breathing, when developed and cultivated. So don't think this is a quick fix. It's not a pill. It's not a Band-Aid. But when cultivating and developing this samadhi, this unification, this exceptional sanity and balance of mind by mindfulness of breathing, this mindfulness of breathing is peaceful. Well, no surprise there. It should be peaceful. The turbulence, the dust, what was it called? The dust and dirt of all this obsessive, compulsive ideation, the frothing at the mouth of the mind, calms. It should be peaceful. No surprise there. He says it's peaceful and sublime. Now that's an interesting word. That's a pretty highfalutin term. Sublime is a Michelangelo painting or a great sculpture, Yosemite Valley. That's sublime. What on earth is sublime about watching, Well, you're not getting anything sublime from the objective side. What's becoming sublime is subjective experience of the breath. Sublime is coming. What's the origin of sublime? Your awareness. Not the instructions, not Buddhism, not the teacher, nothing from outside. I'm not giving anything sublime at all, nothing. But a sublime quality does arrive. It's peaceful, but it's more than peaceful. It's sublime. He goes on. Boy, he's not mincing words here. He says, an ambrosial dwelling. Now, I like ambrosia. An ambrosial dwelling suggests something sweet, something delicious, something you'd really want to bathe in. An ambrosial dwelling, that sounds really good. Where's the ambrosia coming from? Well, not from tactile sensation, not from your nose, not from outside. Only one possible origin. The ambrosial quality is coming, manifesting, emerging from your own mind, which almost is rejoicing in the fact that it's becoming and being settled in balance, free of the extremes of excitation and laxity. This tells volumes about the nature of the mind that is not evident on the surface. Moreover, it's not just peaceful, sublime, and ambrosial. All of that sounds really good to me. But it has also even greater significance than that. I think I've experienced, a long time ago, drugs that make you feel peaceful, sublime, and ambrosial. You remember old days? Yeah, pretty good description. Of course, they wear off. And then when they're worn off, it's just kind of like, oh, that was a good memory. But that was it. They were very groovy. But something more here, peaceful and sublime and ambrosial dwelling, and it, this samadhi, my mindfulness breathing, disperses and quells on the spot unwholesome states whenever they arise. Now that, mescaline never did for me. Don't think, it had no ethical connotation to it at all. I mean, it's really cool. I haven't had it for decades. Not interested. But it never had that quality to it. This is not only peaceful, sublime, and ambrosial, but actually it's remarkably healthy. It's like you've jacked up your psychological immune system. So the viruses of craving and anxiety and pettiness and resentment and blah, 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 they come up, and the mind is so robust. The mind is so, has such fortitude that these mental afflictions or these unwholesome mental states, they just wimp out. Like a person who's really healthy, excellent food, sleeping well, happy, well balanced, comes into a room, as I did recently, where people are hacking and sneezing and blowing their noses, you know, like there's no end to it. And you spend a week with them and you don't get sick. You certainly have the virus, it's just sprayed all over you. But your immune system was up. And while other people succumbed, you didn't. Physical immune system, psychological immune system. This is what this does. Now, this practice, even though it's utterly central, I mean, it's so core, so foundational to the Buddhist tradition, practice in Zen, Theravada, even practice somewhat at lesser extent in Tibetan Buddhism. You notice there's really nothing Buddhist about it. That is, we're not inserting anything into the system. If I should tell you, I've got a fantastic mantra for you, and if you recite this 100,000 times, it is going to purify your mind. It's 100 syllables, so brace yourself. You know, and this is the visualization, and it's going to be a Buddhist deity, and here's the symbols, and they're Buddhist symbols, but it's a really powerful technique. And in fact, what I'm referring to is a powerful technique. It's called Vajrasattva meditation. It's a great practice. It's very Buddhist. I don't know why a non-Buddhist would really want to do it, any more than a non-Christian would want to practice the Jesus prayer. You know, why would you want to do that? Why would a Jew want to practice, you know, centering prayer in the Christian tradition? It doesn't make any sense. So there are practices that are very valuable, but are really valuable for people who are in a particular community, Christian, Buddhist, or what have you. But the breathing is there no matter what. And so on the one hand, it's taught by the Buddha, but there's nothing really Buddhist about this. It's a completely naturalistic process. But let's come back to this final point, this: it disperses and quells on the spot unwholesome states whenever they arise. So I think one can quite reasonably understand this as a bolstering and empowering of your internal immune system, so that even when afflictive thoughts should emerge, it will almost be like being in the presence of a virus that comes in, but it just comes in and then it shed it off and it doesn't do any damage. A thought, an impulse, craving, hostility, whatever it may be, arises, but it just doesn't find any finger hold. It doesn't find a way to latch on and, here's the mudra, get you in its grip. The cognitive fusion doesn't take place. It's like the mental affliction comes courting. And you say, no thank you, I think I won't go out for a date, but have a nice day. But no, I won't date you. I'm too happy as I am. Why would I want to go out with you when I've got a bowl of popcorn and, you know, really good music at home? So there's this, but there's another factor to this too as well, and that is with these so-called mental afflictions, these kleshas, some of which are emotions, most of which actually aren't. But these mental afflictions have a common denominator, a common quality, and that is whenever mental afflictions come in and, performs the coup d'etat, takes over the castle, captures all of your court. That's a metaphor that traces back to classical India. They come and they capture the king. Whenever that happens, whenever mental affliction comes in and takes over, it always comes in with an earmark. And mental afflictions come with a lot of different varieties. Craving is quite different from hostility. And arrogance is quite different from jealousy, and so forth. A lot of different flavors, but they all have something in common. And that is the mental afflictions, when they not only emerge, but they capture. They capture your king, as in a chess game. They all have a common denominator, and that is they all, in varying ways, disrupt the equilibrium of the mind. That they all do. Jealousy, arrogance, anger, so forth and so on. They disrupt the equilibrium. They throw you off balance. So a mental affliction comes up. And a mental affliction, in my experience, you see whether it's true for you, when a mental affliction comes up, it comes with an invitation. Don't you want to attend to what I'm attending to? I've got something I'm really fixated on, something I really want. Don't pay attention to me, look. Or I am so pissed off that this person didn't treat me rightly, this person betrayed my trust, this person blah, 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 blah.
get you right. Look at that. That'll really get you going.
You know? So these mental afflictions, they come in with these little hooks trying to capture the attention and then propel it off to the referent of the mental affliction. And then the feeding frenzy begins. Right? And they perpetuate themselves by... And that's how the mind operates. It's arising in this staccato flow of moments, arising, passing. And like a baby that just needs to be fed every second, you have to keep the trough open. You have to keep on feeding them. Because if you break the supply line, the food line, they dry up real quickly. So if you're attending to these sensations of the breath, which don't arouse either craving or hostility, just attending there, that snips the food line. So in a very simple way, it's quite reasonable, in fact, and it is true that they do, in fact, disperse and quell on the spot unwholesome states whenever they arise. Now, that doesn't mean they'll never arise again. But while doing this practice, and there are the trait effects carrying on after the practice, the mind overall is more balanced, the immune system overall is bolstered. There's the benefit of this practice. And I really like the metaphor which relates to the question earlier today about trusting the body. If we get a wound, and let's start with a trivial one. I'm not going to elaborate on this much, but this, the paper cut. Well, the paper cut we know is so trivial. All you have to do is just keep it clean. And in a couple of days, there's not even a scar, like never even there, right? And that's something that no plastic surgeon in the world can do, but just let your body do it. And lo and behold, 3 days later, where was that paper cut? Son of a gun, it's totally gone. But let's imagine the person with a paper cut does something really foolish and just hops on a plane to Kathmandu, let's say, and finds the grungiest gutter you can find and then just goes trawling. Just take your paper cut and trawl on the gutters of Kathmandu. Well, if you're really lucky, you don't have to be that lucky. You might get gangrene. Paper cut, but then paper cut plus gangrene. And then just watch it creep up your arm until you don't have a hand anymore. You have a black stub. And then you don't have an arm. You got a black, big, long stub. And then the gangrene gets to your heart, and then you've got a body stub because you're dead. Right? So a paper cut can kill you. On the other hand, we know that even severe wounds, really severe, way beyond paper cut, if the good doctor comes in and stitches them together and applies the antiseptic, antibacterial agent and so forth, covers it with a salve, there may be a scar, but it will. The doctor can't do this, but it will heal. It will actually, it's so foolish of me to even talk about this, right? But isn't it amazing that it actually grows over? The doctor can't do that, but if we just keep it clean, then it will do a lot to heal itself, as with, I find even more amazing, broken bones. Mm-hmm. Broken bones, that just blows my mind. Mm-hmm. They actually grow back together again. If you ever had a broken axle in a pickup truck, put a splint on it and see how long it takes. So the body can be likened to a machine, but that analogy only goes so far. So there we are. But that should give us some big grounds for trust, as in cultivating a friendship. In a friendship, if you trust the person and the person comes on through and really warrants your trust, and then you trust again and warrants the trust, after a while you say, this is a trustworthy person, and you might trust that person even for greater issues. The body is earning our trust here. Now clearly, we need doctors on occasion, absolutely, but they're there also to help the body heal itself, sometimes with surgery, sometimes a splint, and so forth. The body deserves our trust. And that's what we're doing in this practice. We're trusting the body, now not in terms of a fracture or an abrasion, but in terms of the disruption, the injuries that have been, wrought on our nervous systems. We get injured. We get injured by life circumstances, by just what comes up. Adversity, trauma, sadness, betrayal, and all kinds of things. And this practice, this mindfulness of breathing, is facilitating opening up the capacity of the body to restore its own balance, to heal itself. So as I mentioned before, We now have two primary imbalances of attention that are addressed in this practice: excitation, laxity, to use short terms. And to balance these with stability and vividness rooted in relaxation, a deepening sense of relaxation. So for some practices, one might wonder, how do I know whether it's working? In the Tibetan tradition, for example, people will do 100,000 mandala offerings, you know, grains of sand and whoosh, you know, reciting something, you're visualizing something, you do that 100,000 times. I've done it. But it may not be so clear, is this working or not? You know, when I get to 50,000, what's different? 75,000, calluses, besides that, what's different? You know, it's not so obvious because it's not designed to bring about some change you can necessarily see coming right out of the practice. It's not to say it's a bad practice, but don't get your expectations up too high. They're going to say, "Eureka, I never experienced anger again. I just finished 100,000 mandala offerings." Maybe, maybe not. But when it comes to shamatha, this really is not faith-based. If it's not working, you should know about it. You should find some other method or do the practice more effectively. And that is shamatha practice of any sort. Mindfulness of breathing, there's a wide array of other practices. Shamatha is working. It's doing what it was designed to do if it does indeed induce or bring forth a deeper sense of ease, stability, and vividness. If it's doing that, it's working. And if it's not, it's not working. In which case, modify the practice or find something else to do, right? And so the faculties that we are utilizing and refining to bring forth this extraordinary, this exceptional, sublime, and ambrosial balance of the mind are two, and they're called mindfulness and I shall call introspection. Sometimes you'll see mindfulness and clear comprehension, awareness, full awareness, vigilance. I've seen all of the above. But as I explained earlier, I'm going to choose introspection because this samprajanya, it's called in Sanskrit, is always reflexive. It's always an introspecting. So I can't practice samprajanya on you. I can practice mindfulness on you, mindfulness on the room full of people. I can't practice introspection on you because that's looking outwards, whereas introspection, samprajanya, is always reflexive. Attending to my presence here, my body, my speech, my mind. So two faculties. Now, definitions. Definitions. The type of mindfulness that is, I think, very widely practiced here, wonderfully adopted and disseminated by people like Jon Kabat-Zinn with mindfulness-based stress reduction, more and more fully and happily embraced in the psychological profession. Scientists studying now, it seems like scores and scores of studies of the effects of mindfulness for heart problems, for all kinds of problems, physical and psychological problems. The type of mindfulness that's being studied here, widely disseminated, especially in the Vipassana tradition and so forth, tends to be, and you probably know what I'm about to say, this very momentary, moment-to-moment, kind of an open awareness, an attentiveness, non-judgmental, non-reactive to whatever comes up, just being present with whatever's coming up. So Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition, he's phrased it different ways, but moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness of whatever comes up. Very useful. I think one simply can't say it's not useful. The scientific evidence is utterly compelling. So, so useful to many, I would say, tens of thousands of people now. It is interesting to note that no such definition is found in any traditional Buddhist literature. It's a recent definition. Very useful recent definition. So I want to say those two. I've looked through the Pali literature, the Sanskrit, and so forth. I've not seen a trace of that definition anywhere before 1960 or so. And it's extremely useful. And there are no such things as language police, or if there are, they should fire themselves. Because words don't define themselves. Not God, not matter, not energy, not space, time, or mindfulness. None of these words define themselves. And a definition will stick insofar as useful. That's all it is. It's utilitarian. Is that definition useful or not? This definition, I think, is unequivocally, to my mind, indisputably, very, very helpful. But it may be also, and this is all I'm really saying here, I'm not here to enter into debate or which is better and all that kind of baloney. But it may be also, since that is not a traditional definition of mindfulness in the Theravada tradition, Indian Buddhism, or Tibetan Buddhism, it might be interesting to see, well, how is that juxtaposed with traditional definitions, for which there's a fair degree of, how do you say, overlap or congruence between definitions from the Pali, the Sanskrit, and the Tibetan. So what I've taken here, because I have no interest in my own opinions on this point, I am interested in How is this term, mindfulness, defined in the classic literature that's based upon centuries and centuries of meditation and rooted in the Buddha's own teachings? So the most authoritative commentator in the whole Theravada tradition, 5th century, 4th century, was the Indian scholar by the name of Buddhaghosa, renowned in the whole Theravada tradition, really after the Buddha, who has greater authority in terms of commenting and explicating the Buddha's teachings. And he defines mindfulness in his classic work, the Visuddhimagga, or the Path of Purification. It's technical, but I think it's worth spending a few minutes on. It says, by means of mindfulness, they, that is to say, other concomitant mental processes, the other processes that are arising simultaneous with mindfulness from moment to moment to moment, by means of mindfulness, they, other mental processes, remember, or it itself remembers. Mindfulness remembers, or it is simply just remembering. Thus, it is mindfulness. Now, that's rooted exactly in what the Buddha himself said about sati, or mindfulness. It is remembering things that took place a long time ago. That's sati. It's a primary word that they use for recollection. Do you recall what you had for lunch, or if you had lunch? If you have that ability, you're exercising your faculty of sati. Right? That's sati. On the one hand. On the other hand, sati is not always retrospective, not always looking to the past. We have now, and the Buddha himself said it, we don't have to make up anything here, that when this anapanasati samadhi, this samadhi by way of mindfulness of breathing, is developed and cultivated, such and such effects come out, ensue, right? Well, when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you're not sitting there remembering 5 weeks ago I had a really good breath. That was a rich one. That was a really hearty breath. Good old days. You know, you're not thinking about old breaths. You're not remembering breaths that went by. What you are doing is recollecting the flow of breath in the present moment. Now, think of this oscillating motion, this coming together, coming together, coming together. This is the recollecting mind that is basically subject to entropy. The mind wants to fly apart at the hinges, the attention. We're just accustomed to it, to distraction, to coming apart at the seams. And the mindfulness of breathing, if we think of the flow of attention as being a flow of staccato events, the mindfulness of breathing, the ongoing recollectedness of the flow of the breathing, is a recollection, 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 converging around, converging around, converging around the sensations of the breath in an ongoing flow. Now, how would you do that if you sit down to practice and you don't have somebody verbally guiding you through the session? Let's imagine all the instructions are given at the beginning of the session, then you have 24 minutes silence. You get 12 minutes into the session. How do you know what to practice? And not just sit there and, how did I get here? what am I doing here? You know, how do you know what to practice 12 minutes into the session, or for that matter, 12 seconds into the session? You're sitting there for a particular practice. Remembering the instructions. So even in practicing mindfulness of breathing, you have to recall, what were the instructions? What do you do when you breathe in? What do you do when you breathe out? If the mind starts wondering, what do you do then? What is introspection? What's mindfulness? What was that again? And so it is, in fact, when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you are recalling the instructions that you heard earlier until they become completely just fluid and spontaneous. And then in the present moment, you're practicing an ongoing flow of recollectedness of this flow of sensations from moment to moment to moment. So we have recollective or retrospective mindfulness, which is memory. We have present-centered mindfulness, as in mindfulness of breathing. And there's also prospective mindfulness. Prospective mindfulness. We use it all the time. Right? And that is, for example, perhaps one of your spouses or somebody at home this morning said, oh, you're going to go after that retreat, but it ends at 5. Good. When you come back, when you're on your drive home, you'll drive by the market. We're out of bread, we're out of butter, and we're also out of cheese. So we want some dinner, and we need all three of those. So did you remember? Butter, cheese, and bread. Make sure you buy on the way home. Then you're here for 8 hours, and you're not thinking about butter, cheese, or bread. And you're following the breath and so forth. And then you get into the car. You turn the ignition, and you're heading home, and the market's coming up on your right. The question comes up, do you or do you not remember? what you had agreed to purchase on the way home. If you do, you've just exercised your faculty of prospective memory. You remember to do something in the present, in the future. The present eventually catches up to the future, and then you do it. That's also sati. So mindfulness can be retrospective, present-centered, and prospective. And the type of mindfulness taught in the Vipassana tradition nowadays, this moment-to-moment, right in the present moment, that is a form of mindfulness. It's a form of mindfulness. It's one of three versions. Now, within that, it may be totally open, as in choiceless awareness, or in the Dzogchen tradition, open presence. That's a possibility. But when the Buddha speaks of samadhi by way of mindfulness of breathing, that's not open presence. That's a shamatha practice. You are selecting, attending to the sensations, let's say, at the breath at the apertures of the nostrils, which means you're not attending to all the other stuff. That's why it's called samadhi practice. So mindfulness comes in multiple varieties, multiple flavors. And the way it's defined nowadays, and being psychologically studied, neurophysiologically studied, and so forth, is one very important strand in the rich fabric of mindfulness. So Buddhaghosa says, number one, it is remembering. It is that very act of remembering, thus it is mindfulness. Now, but it gets interesting. This is technical, but I think not just egghead or, how do you say, sterile academic. Its characteristic is not floating. It's not, maybe the word is already self-explanatory, but I'll do it this way. I'm going to attend to you right now in a very engaged way. Your face I'm attending to. And I'm going to try to do a cartoon of what it's like to float. Not floating. Now watch floating begin. I never got distracted. You didn't see the attention going off here or there, getting caught up in thoughts. It was just an implosion. And the Tibetan word that we translate as laxity literally means to sink. So you saw me coming out to meet you. Boom. And then you saw me getting lost, imploding, going like that. That's floating. That's not mindfulness. Its property is not losing. So if we ask, what is the opposite of mindfulness? It is forgetfulness. Mindfulness is remembering or recollecting, and the opposite is not remembering, not recollecting, forgetting. Something in the past, the future, or the present. Its manifestation is guarding or the state of being face to face with an object. So a close encounter of the very first kind, whether it's attending to somebody's face, attending to the sensations of the breath, as we'll do in the final session after the break today, attending to the space of the mind and whatever arises in it, rather like looking into the mirror of the mind and seeing what are the events arising from moment to moment, very much in the style of this Vipassana tradition, very much of that quality. But we're going to put it right into shamatha. Its basis is strong noting or the close applications of mindfulness of the body and so on. It should be seen as like a post due to its state of being set in the object. That is, this is deliberate and it's voluntary. Whether the object of mindfulness is vast, as in cultivating mindfulness by way of loving kindness towards all sentient beings, what are you attending to? All sentient beings, pretty vast object, right? Or you may focus, in Tibetan tradition, you may visualize a radiant incandescent orb of light the size of a pea in the center of your heart chakra and develop samadhi on that. That's the nitroglycerin approach to shamatha. Do it well, very cool. Do it not so well, you blow your mind. But that's very single-pointed. That's an incandescent little orb of light at the heart and becomes single-pointed there. Don't try that at home, not without good guidance. It can be actually dangerous. But the simple point is mindfulness may have as its object something vast or something small, something fluid, as in the ongoing flow of sensations of the breath, or something relatively static, like in the Tibetan tradition, visualizing a mental image. Mental image, an orb of light, the face of your mother, a Buddha image, or what have you. So it's seen as like a post due to the state of being set in the object and as like a gatekeeper because it guards the gate of the eye and so on. So that's the definition of mindfulness, and introspection is simply the repeated monitoring of the state of one's body, speech, and mind. In the practice of shamatha, it's monitoring to see whether either laxity or excitation has set in. Now, maybe we should spend a couple of minutes, then we'll take our break soon. wonder why the Buddha emphasized this practice so much, because he clearly did. He taught a wide variety, some very interesting practices, but this one most frequently. And one thing about the flow, that we're attending to something that's dynamic, that's ever-changing, and yet it has a coherence to it. It's not just this, that, and the other thing. But it's not locked in. It's not just trying to focus on something static or stable, but to the contrary, the flow of the breath, the flow of the breath. We have that novel and then the movie. Remember The Horse Whisperer in the movie Robert Redford? There are different ways of breaking or subduing or training a wild horse, and one is to break its spirit. Just have it jump around until it's broken, and then ready to keel over. Good, train that horse. Next. So the one way of doing it, and that's the whiplash your mind into shape. You know, just beat it, cajole it, scold it. Lots of frustration would be really good for that. That's one way of doing it, but this mindfulness of breathing is more of a gentling of attention. Relaxing with every out-breath, just going with the flow of the breath. It's very soothing, gentle, it's good for the body, but it's a very gentle approach to it. And moreover, mindfulness of breathing, and we'll end on this point before the break, has a unique quality, and that is, whereas for all other shamatha methods, as you progress in the practice, which simply means becoming more relaxed, stable, and vivid of attention, the object that you're attending to becomes more and more clear, vivid, sharp, distinct. Mindfulness of breathing uniquely has a feedback loop built into the very process of it, such that as your whole system calms, your mind calms, and then the nervous system, the prana system, starts settling, and I can only use loose terminology here, settles into a calmer, a more balanced state, deeper equilibrium. As that happens, the whole nervous system calming down, the volume of air needed decreases. Hence, the sensations of the in and out flow of the breath become subtler. As it does so, you either remain continually engaged with these increasingly subtle sensations of the breath, which call for increasing vividness to attend to them, or you lose it, and your mind just goes into a spin-off, into distraction. Right? But as you practice here, rather than the object becoming distincter and sharper and bolder, it gets subtler and subtler and subtler. It's like it's leading you by the hand. Leading you by the hand, the more grounded, balanced you become, the subtler it becomes. It says, can you take this? Can your vividness arise to this? Oh, it can? Oh, good. How about this? How about this? How about, oh, I've lost you? Where did you go? And then it comes back again as you start getting caught up in thoughts of craving and anxiety and so forth. The breathing starts and catches you. Oh, I left you behind a half mile ago? I'm so sorry. Oh, take me. Can you watch this? Can you watch this? It's got a feedback loop built right into it. No other practice has that. So it's very gentle. It's a very friendly. It's almost like a mutual friendship. I help you, you help me. It's really a wonderful practice, and you don't even need to be sitting cross-legged or in the supine position. Start looking forward to, this will be one of the strongest challenges that I'll give to anybody who lives in the city, but if you can start looking forward to red stoplights, you're well on the path, grasshopper, and that is you're coming to an intersection, and you're thinking, maybe it'll turn red, maybe it'll turn... Oh, good. I've got at least 45 seconds. Season the day as much as you can, as often as you can. Season the day with 15 seconds and 45 seconds and 2 minutes. As many times as you can, season the day and just bring your awareness back to the present and breathe, breathe, breathe out. And allow the breath to come in. Until the light turns and say, oh, green again. Okay, session's over. Keep your eyes open, by the way. People behind that, they start getting irritated as mindfulness of breathing practitioners when we practice with the eyes closed. But even in a very, very busy day, and I know what those are like, I really do not believe anybody's so busy they can't take out 30 seconds here and a minute there. And just pause and season the day. Just cultivate sanity as many times a day as possible. So helpful. So much less wear and tear. So let's take a break and we'll come back. And we'll practice settling the mind. We'll have one session, and we will return at, if you wish, 4:05.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.